At any time now at the farm, the snakes will begin to stir, and we share the place with a vast spaghetti of particularly venomous varieties. So snakes, I guess, they're scary, but as well as that, they're creepy, which is, I think, a quite distinct response. And it's odd because their kin, the lizards, even very large ones, our goannas, don't make you feel creepy. I love snakes in a way. I'm terribly impressed with them. But there's something about them that makes the skin crawl. You know the feeling. You might be watching a horror movie, or unexpectedly you feel it when you just meet someone. The hair goes up on the back of the neck, the shiver down the spine. In extreme cases, the cold sweat. So, yes, there are things that are more than scary. They're creepy. Which led us to wonder whether all creepy things have something in common. What's going inside our brain to set off these physical responses? A recent survey found that the creepiest profession is the radio broadcaster. No. The clown, followed by taxidermists, sex shop owners, and funeral directors. An eclectic but hardly surprising list. But what is it exactly that makes clowns creepy? Now, someone who's been reading and thinking and writing about this phenomenon is the decidedly uncreepy Dr. David Livingstone Smith. David is Professor of Philosophy at the University of New England in Biddeford, Maine, and author of an article that appeared in the digital magazine Aeon entitled A Theory of Creepiness. And we welcome him to our little wireless program. David, what distinguishes creepiness from other sorts of fear?
Oh, pardon me. Creepiness is something which is, I think, quite distinct from fear. So we feel fear when we have a sense that we are in danger in some way. There's some sort of actual or impending threat. But creepiness is an attitude of simultaneous fascination and repulsion. So when we encounter something creepy, we're drawn to looking at it. At the same time, we want to get away from it.
You quote a wonderful word of Freud's, and I'm going to risk a clumsy attempt at pronunciation, Unheimlichkeit.
Yes, Unheimlichkeit.
See, I got it wrong. I got it wrong.
You were close. You were really close. it's Freud didn't coin the term. It's a German word that is conventionally translated into English as uncanny. I don't think that really captures it very well, because uncanny is a rather pallid word. We could say of someone that they have an uncanny ability to predict the winners of the World Cup. Say, and there's nothing, you know, spooky about that. Unheimlich, which literally means unhomey, unhomelike, I think is better translated as creepy. Yeah, so Freud picked that up and attempted to theorize it a bit.
There's a great deal of interest in creepiness, commercialized in the zombie cinema culture, in Dracula movies, and of course in many sideshows at state fairs, or as we have them in Australia, at royal shows. So we have an insatiable appetite to be tantalized by it.
Yes, that's right. And I think the reason for that, as I'm sure we're going to get into as we talk more, is that creepy things tend not to fit into our conventional frameworks. They seem to subvert the boundaries between the categories that we normally use to make sense of the world.
Well, a term that you employ, which I find fascinating, is threat ambiguity theory, TAT. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there was recently a paper by a couple of psychologists named McAndrews, and I believe her name is pronounced Konki, but I'm not sure. So I apologize to you if I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly and you're listening to this. And they tried to theorize creepiness as a response to threat ambiguity. So they suggest that when we experience another person as creepy, it's because we're uncertain as to whether or not that person poses a threat to us, or if we think they pose a threat to us, what sort of a threat they
pose. The whole world is currently in this state of mind over Trump.
Yes, yes, with great justification. I would say the whole world is pretty sure that he does pose a threat. He's a danger, yes.
Okay, so you make this distinction. If there is an absolutely apparent, urgent physical danger, that leads to an absolutely familiar response. But with ambiguity, with this element of mystery, with this uncertainty, we don't know what to do.
Yeah, so the psychologists who did this study suggest we sort of enter a state of cognitive paralysis when that happens. We don't know what to do, because if we're not certain if something poses a threat or what sort of a threat it might pose, then it's difficult, indeed impossible, to respond immediately with some course of action in relation to that person.
And we go from TAT to CAT, categorical ambiguity theory.
Yeah. So TAT was an attempt to explain the creepiness response to other people. CAT, categorical ambiguity theory, is, I think, a much more general account of creepiness. So there are circumstances in which, and these circumstances are exploited often in horror films, in which we encounter something which, although it doesn't elicit the sense that there's danger, nonetheless produces in us this intense, high-octane response of regarding it as creepy. So if you imagine a severed hand crawling across the floor, that doesn't seem particularly dangerous. If you want to neutralize it even further, imagine it's a baby's hand crawling across the floor. It's pretty innocuous, but deeply, profoundly.
David, it is an astonishing coincidence that just a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about a movie I remember from childhood called The Beast with Five Fingers, which was starred a hand crawling across the floor, then up the trouser leg to throttle one. So, okay. Yeah. The principle behind creepiness, of course, is evoked not only in modern cinema, but going back to, say, the Waxworks Museum, and this strange grey area between the animate and the inanimate.
Yes. So that goes back to what was really the seminal publication on creepiness, which appeared in 1906. And it was written by a German psychiatrist named Ernst Jentsch. And it's, the title of it is typically translated On the Psychology of the Uncanny. As you know, I think this should be The Psychology of Creepiness, the word being Unheimlichen here. Yeah, and Jentsch is the first person apparently to argue that when we're creeped out by something, it's precisely because we can't manage to univocally characterize it as one kind of thing or another kind of thing. He gives the example of corpses. So we respond to corpses, if we're not accustomed to corpses, as people, quite understandably. But we also are aware that they're slabs of cold flesh, right? And as long as we are torn between these two visions of what a corpse is, we experience the corpse as unheimlich, as creepy. Similarly, again, this was a very interesting forward-looking example. Jentsch gives the example of figures in a wax museum, which was, you know, very high-tech in 1906. And we might enter a wax museum and see a figure, say a figure, to use your previous example, of Donald Trump. And it's so realistic that at a quick glance, we might mistake it for the actual guy, the real person, God forbid. And when we look a little bit more closely, we see it's not quite right. So the eyes are dead, the skin is just off, it's waxy, and the facial expression is fixed, there's no movement. And when we see that, of course, we're drawn to classifying this as a piece of inanimate matter. At the same time, our initial response persists, this is a person, and our minds are pulled in two directions at once. As long as that persists, we experience the waxwork figure as creepy.
I remember Walt Disney trying to blur those realities or unrealities with his Abraham Lincoln at Disneyland, the audio animatronic Abe Lincoln, who would stand rather stiffly and then give us the Gettysburg Address. But the creepiness survived.
Yeah, that was like zombie Lincoln.
Yeah, I think that's right on the money. So I understand that some cultures, see, have different categories for creepiness. That, for example, the pig is an interesting case.
Yeah, so this has to do with the work done by the anthropologist Mary Douglas back in the 60s. She wrote a very wonderful book called Purity and Danger. It's a very confusing book, but it's a wonderful book. It's rich in ideas. And what Douglas suggests is that in every culture, we have these schemes, these what I as a philosopher would call metaphysical schemes, that is sort of maps of the kinds of things that exist, these categories. And she argues that, of course, whenever you have a system of these hard and fast categories, you're going to sooner or later be confronted with anomalies, things that don't fit in. And those things that don't fit in are felt to be dangerous, polluting, abominable. And she argues, and it's been a very influential argument, that the food taboos in the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament can be understood in those terms. So the ancient Hebrews had these categories of animals, and these categories of animals had certain stereotypical characteristics, like chewing the cud or having cloven hooves, so on. And some animals, like the pig, seemed to violate those categories. They were sort of in between, just like zombies are in between living and dead. And those become then taboo foodstuffs.
David, you talked about waxworks being a cutting-edge technology at the beginning of the 20th century. In our time, of course, we have to deal with the implications of artificial intelligence and robotics. And I think the first genuinely creepy high-tech creature was the bodiless hell in the Space Odyssey. But we're now moving into a great variety of zombies. And here we're going to have these same sort of equivocations, even by the designers of them.
Yeah, that's right. So this really brings us to a very important contribution from 1970. A Japanese roboticist named Masahiro Mori wrote in an obscure journal an article, a very short article, I believe it was about 3 pages long, which was immensely, immensely influential. And this article, well, the conventional translation from the Japanese is the Uncanny Valley. The word translated as Uncanny Bukimi is better translated, so I'm told, as eerie or creepy. So think of it as the Valley of Creepiness, which sounds very creepy, doesn't it? What Mori predicted is that as we create more and more lifelike anthropomorphic robots, the sense of familiarity of those individuals interacting with those robots will increase until the robot is almost indistinguishable from a real human being, but not quite. So when it starts approximating the animatronic Lincoln or the waxwork figure, he predicted that when that happens, people will start responding to the robots with an intense sense of aversion, that the robots will be experienced not as familiar, but as creepy, as disturbing, as bukimi. And so we have this precipitous drop in comfort when that happens. Now, this effect is taken quite seriously. There's a large literature on this, both in the field of robotics and in the area of cinematographers trying to create realistic computer-generated animations. So the problem with these animations, and there are a number of movies in which have featured these, is that the human figures, well, as a number of reviewers say, they're just creepy. they're disturbing, even when they're supposed to be sympathetic.
You're not at all frivolous in this essay, because you talk about using our understanding of what we find creepy to understand how we dehumanize people.
Yes, that's right. My interest in creepiness actually came out of my work on dehumanization, which has been the main topic of research for me for a number of years now. So when I talk about dehumanization, I mean the tendency to conceive of other populations as less than human, as subhuman creatures. And just a moment's reflection will tell you that many of the worst atrocities that human beings have ever perpetrated on one another, you know, from Nazi Germany to Rwanda to closer to home for you, Tasmania, have involved dehumanization, have involved assigning less than human status to whole populations of members of our species. Now, when this happens, it's actually not straightforward, in my view. So one might classify Jews as vermin, say, as the Nazis did, but it's, I think, virtually impossible for us at the same time to escape recognizing that these others are human beings. We're a highly, highly social species, and we're attuned to one another and to be able to recognize one another as members of the same species. So when dehumanization happens, the dehumanizer is torn between two visions of the other, one as a subhuman animal, the other as a human being. And those two things together then generate the creepiness response. So that we make monsters of those whom we dehumanize. And they become all the more disturbing and all the more threatening. And this then, in a vicious sort of spiral, elicits more and more harsh, degrading, and deadly behavior towards them.
I can remember being a little boy going to a local Protestant state school, and across the road there was the Catholic school, and it was like Belfast there, because we'd chant Catholic dogs stink like frogs jumping out of hollow logs, and they'd retaliate with state full of hate. My best friend was over there, and we'd walk home together happy as Larry, but during school hours that was the line that was drawn, and I can distinctly remember the physical fear I felt at the sight of nuns. You know, and that projects into 21st century hostility to Muslim women in burqas.
Yeah. I think this is something I've not thought about, the nun cases, and I've not had traumatic early experiences with nuns, so it's hard for me to resonate with that. But I would guess that the element of concealment is important there. I mean, we find people wearing masks as creepy.
Well, that takes us back to the clown, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So clowns are just notoriously creepy. In the survey that you mentioned right at the beginning of this conversation, clowns were rated as the creepiest profession. Well, why should that be? I think it's because of the clown's makeup, that clowns are given this fixed facial expression, which is, it's mask-like. So it belies the characteristic of a real living, breathing human being, which is to have a mobile facial expression. And so we're caught then again in this strange, uncanny space when we're interacting with clouds.
David, you're an extraordinary fellow. Thank you very, very much for your time. Dr. David Livingstone Smith, Professor of Philosophy at the University of New England in Biddeford, Maine, and the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave and Exterminate Others, published by St. Martin's Press.